Welcome to episode 12 in the fifth season of Justice with John Carpe, a podcast from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. I'm the show's producer, Kevin Steele, and with me is our host, John Carpe, who is the president and founder of the center. Now, later in the show, we'll discuss a leaked secret RCMP report to the federal government, both politicians and bureaucrats, that predicts social unrest in Canada due to things like poor economic conditions. So what's going on here? Are the cops trying to urge the government to get to work to fix things before the situation gets worse? Or is Canada's top police force handing big government control freaks a plausible excuse to strip us of our constitutional rights? Let's speculate. But we'll start with a column John has written about the effort to remove the religious defense that is available to anyone charged with a hate crime in this country. Those attempting to do this are using a two-pronged approach, led by the Bloc Québécois, and to go by a March 29 Globe and Mail article, they have the support of special interest groups. First prong is the introduction of a private member's bill by Bloc leader Yves-François Blanchet put forward last November. This bill would remove Section 319, subsection 3, known as the religious defense, from the criminal code. The second prong is a proposal to amend Bill C-63, the Online Harms Act, introduced at the end of February, to remove said section from the criminal code. This was suggested by Bloc MP Réal Fortin in the previously mentioned Globe article, and in there he is supported by LGBT groups and political activists like Bernie Farber. So, John, what's wrong with what the Bloc is proposing?
Well, this would potentially criminalize. It opens the door to having certain verses in the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Quran, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, religious texts that speak disapprovingly of homosexual behavior, could be considered criminal hate speech by somebody who is reading those aloud in public. And it's also a step towards a potential future ban on saying, well, you know, the only Quran or Torah or New Testament or Catholic catechism that can be bought and sold in Canada is a proper one with the hateful passages removed. And anybody who says that that's far-fetched should think about where has Canada been going the last 50, 40, 30, 20, 10 years on free speech, on respect for religious freedom. And we've seen this movie before. In the 1990s, there was agitation, ultimately successful, to add sexual orientation to the human rights legislation of the provinces. The human rights legislation would typically say you cannot discriminate in the provision of goods and services to members of the public. You cannot discriminate with hiring practices or promotions within an organization. You cannot discriminate based on race, national or ethnic origin, sex, religion, skin color, so on and so forth. So over the years, there have been these additions, the most recent ones being that you cannot discriminate on the basis of gender identity and gender expression, which creates a problem. I'm aware of a Justice Center supporter contacted me a few weeks ago and said that in his place of business, there is a man who has recently decided to that he is a woman or wants to become a woman and wants access to the women's change rooms at this place, women's bathrooms, rather, at this place of employment. So if that goes before a human rights tribunal, they might well rule in favor of the man that wants to go into the women's bathrooms, and they might rule against the employer because you have that added to the as a prohibited ground of discrimination. So sexual orientation was added so that you could not discriminate. If somebody came into your store who that you thought was homosexual, then you could not refuse service on that basis. So it became added on with, you know, race, religion, sex, so on and so forth. Now, people warned that this was going to lead to religious people getting in trouble for saying what their scriptures teach about homosexual behavior. And it was like, oh no, that's all paranoid. That will never, ever happen. Pastors and priests will be able to have full freedom to continue to, if they want to preach that it's a sin for two guys to have sex with each other, if they want to say that that's sinful, they can continue doing that. And this will never, ever be used. It's only going to be for purposes of employment and, you know, provision of goods and services to the public. Well, that's proven to be completely false. And there have been many, 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 many cases all across Canada where people have gotten into trouble for saying that for teaching what the Islamic, evangelical, Christian, Catholic, Orthodox, Jewish, et cetera, teachings about human sexuality. People have gotten in trouble with that, over that, with human rights legislation. So it's not far-fetched at all.
Okay, but if they've gotten into trouble with it, that sounds like they've already set the precedent for getting rid of this. In other words, this is just a formality. People are already getting in trouble for it. Or are they availing themselves of that defense and the judge is saying, okay, well, yes, you are allowed to use that defense and you can go free?
Well, here's the important distinction. So what we have in Canada right now is that if you are not careful in the language that you use, if you're a religious person and you're teaching what your faith, again, some examples being traditional evangelical Christian teaching, Roman Catholic, Islamic, Orthodox, Judaism, these faiths have teachings against homosexual behavior. If you are preaching that in the public square, if you're standing on a street corner handing out flyers, well, it costs nothing to file a complaint. So even if the complaint is eventually dismissed, the process is the punishment. But you actually, if you're not careful in your choice of words, you could be found to be in violation of provincial human rights legislation or federal human rights legislation. What's happening with this bill proposed by the Bloc Québécois leader, Mr. Blanchet, is to change the Criminal Code of Canada. So we're talking criminal law. So we're talking Section 319 of the Criminal Code of Canada, which prohibits the willful promotion of hatred against an identifiable group. An identifiable group refers to a section of the public that could be identified on the basis of race, national or ethnic origin, religion, sex, gender identity, gender expression, sexual orientation, religion. I don't know if I'm repeating myself, but there's a list there. So you, and I always get asked, you know, can Prime Minister Trudeau be charged criminally for promoting hatred against people that didn't get injected with the COVID vaccine? And the answer is no, he cannot, because that is not an identifiable group as enumerated in the criminal code, right? So the willful promotion of hatred against an identifiable group only pertains to what is listed there,
okay,
which is the race, religion, gender, so on and so forth. Now, there are defenses. If you are criminally charged with the willful promotion of hatred, one defense is truth. So, for example, if you say that a particular ethnic group, that they have higher rates of alcoholism and family violence and crime and incarceration and lower rates of achievement, if you get charged with criminal hate speech, you could defend yourself by saying, well, here's all the data. What I said about this ethnic group is actually true, and you could be acquitted on that basis. So truth is a defense, which, by the way, is not under human rights legislation. The second defense available in the criminal code is what you might summarize as a religious defense, and it says, if in good faith the accused person expressed or attempted to establish by an argument, an opinion on a religious subject, or an opinion based on a belief in a religious text. So this is a defense, and I'm going to get very graphic here and read some passages from some scriptures. The Torah states in Leviticus 20, verse 13, quote, if a man has sexual relations with a man, as one does with a woman, both of them have done what is detestable. They are to be put to death. Their blood will be on their own heads. End of quote. In the New Testament, St. Paul, in his first letter to Timothy, writes, quote, We also know that the law is made not for the righteous, but for lawbreakers and rebels, the ungodly and sinful, the unholy and irreligious, for the sexually immoral, for those practicing homosexuality, for slave traders and liars and perjurers, and for whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine, end quote. So you see, practicing homosexuality is included with slave trading, lying, perjury, unholy, irreligious, so on and so forth. The Catechism of the Catholic Church at number 2357 states, quote, basing itself on sacred scripture, which presents homosexual acts as acts of grave depravity, tradition has always declared that homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered. They are contrary to the natural law, end quote. And the Quran, chapter 7, verses 80, 81 states, quote, and remember when Lot scolded the men of his people, saying, do you commit a shameful deed that no man has ever done before? You lust after men instead of women. You are certainly transgressors, end of quote. So, today, if you were preaching on one of these passages and you were criminally charged with hate speech, you could avail yourself of a defense under Criminal Code Section 319 sub 3 that you are expressing an opinion on a religious subject or an opinion based on a belief in a religious text. So they could say, look, when you denounce, when you say that it's a sin for two people of the same sex to have sex together, you're promoting hatred against an identifiable group on the basis of sexual orientation. Well, you can say that you were expressing an opinion based on a religious text, and so you could refer to the Torah, the Quran, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the New Testament, and you could say it's an opinion based on a religious text, and then you would have a defense. So the block is saying, let's get rid of that religious defense, and if that bill passes, Bill C-367, and so this religious defense is repealed from the criminal code, then you're going to be in a situation where people can be criminally charged for preaching what their faith says about homosexual sex.
Okay, but isn't that what he's, you know, that's what they're attempting to do. They're trying to say, well, nobody should be able to hide behind religion, you know, to promote hatred. I think that was what the block member said, something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing, of course. What say you to that? I mean, it's, you know, that's obviously he's taking it head on, and that's where he's going.
Yeah, Bloc MP Réal Fortin, just as you said, nobody should be allowed to escape prosecution by, you know, hiding behind religion. Okay, this presupposes, this is coming from people who have a radically different understanding of human sexuality from what socially conservative and religious conservative people would have. A Muslim, an Orthodox Jew, a practicing Catholic, evangelical Christian or conservative Christian, when they are explaining what their faith teaches about human sexuality, they're not hateful. They're just saying, look, this is what the text teaches. And it's not limited to gay people. There's other, you know, prostitution is denounced to people of the opposite sex who are not married to each other, who are having sex. That's denounced. Masturbation is denounced. So there's a whole big code there. So a religious person would say, look, this is not hateful. This is just that our religion teaches that sexual behavior is supposed to take place within certain boundaries, namely marriage of a man and a woman. And what Bloc MP Réal Fortin and others like him, many people in Canada, when they hear what a religious text says about gay sex, they just assume that it's hateful. And this, of course, gets back to the whole problem with hate speech in the first place. It's so subjective as to what is or is not hateful.
Right, but they've included, at least in the article that I read, which appeared in just about every major publication, that, you know, they've included Jewish groups as well speaking out, and they've used the example of the Hamas protests or the protests supporting the people in Gaza as, you know, the rise in anti-Semitism, and therefore, you know, we shouldn't allow those people to hide behind any kind of religious text, and that's why we need to do this. They're using not just the gay groups, they're using a whole bunch of different people, including Bernie Farber of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. They're using all of those people here to gang up to push this agenda. Now, is it as broad as that, or is it just simply, you know, we're looking at religious texts banning this one particular group? You know, that's what I'm wondering. You know, are they aiming it at hate groups, or are they aiming it at religious people?
Well, it's really up to whoever is in power how they're going to enforce that. And it's not just about sexuality and sexual behavior. There are at least two religions, and probably more, that teach that they are the only way to get to heaven, those being Christianity and Islam. I have heard from Muslims, numerous conversations with Muslims over the years, that if somebody deliberately rejects Islam, they're not going to make it to heaven. They're going to go elsewhere. And they're most Christian, or at least a lot of Christian groups also say that Christ is the only way to heaven, which somebody could say, well, that's going to, it's promoting hatred against members of other religions by suggesting that their religion's inferior because it doesn't, you know, allow you to get to heaven. So again, you get the bringing of charges for hate speech. And anybody who thinks this is far-fetched should consider what happened to Bill Whatcott in Ontario a number of years ago. I think it was 2015, 2016. It was quite a long time ago. This is a social conservative guy who expresses, I guess, you know, Christian perspective on homosexuality, but he does so in a very, in a way that's very inflammatory and very offensive to a lot of people. He and a bunch of his friends, allies, followers, they all dressed up as green zombies. They were green gay zombies that marched in the Toronto Pride Parade. And they handed out small packages, which appeared to be, it looked like a package into which one would put a condom. But instead of a condom, there's a tract in there. And it said that gay sex could lead to various diseases and that it's going to jeopardize your soul. And you need to repent and, repent of your ways. Otherwise, you're not going to heaven. And it was a tract. It was a pamphlet. He was criminally charged with hate speech. Mm-hmm. And when he ultimately, and this took a very long time, ultimately the trial took place and the ruling took place, he was ultimately acquitted, as is very appropriate. And the Crown appealed that. And now the Ontario Court of Appeal has ordered a new trial. And I think the powers that be very much want to see this guy get a criminal record because they just can't stand the message that he's preaching. And so this is what happens when you empower politicians and bureaucrats and crown prosecutors and police to decide what is or is not hateful. It is so subjective.
Yes, but I would suggest, unfortunately, a lot of Canadians say, good, that's what we want, you know. We want the power, even though it could be turned against them at one point. I just want to go back to that when you were talking about, you know, one religion claiming it's being the sole gateway to heaven, or it's to the afterlife.
The only true religion. The only true religion.
So that, I guess, is one way of actually pitting religions against each other. And by taking away that defense, they then can start tearing each other apart in courts.
Well, this is another thing that people use these kinds of laws, including the criminal, as well as at the human rights level, they use it against their political opponents.
Well, there's one section of your article I found very interesting, and that was sort of the historical aspect of that. I think it was the Keekster ruling where it was 4-3, and the dissenting judges said, well, you know, it's because of this defense that is allowed that actually makes it sort of permissible. Maybe you could just run over that. That I found very intriguing, the fact that, you know, the judges singled it out as one of the reasons.
Yeah, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled in 1990 in a case called R versus Keekstra to validate, to uphold the Criminal Code Section 319 banning the willful promotion of hatred. Jim Keekstra was a teacher in a public school in Alberta. Important to note public because after after Jim Keekstra became well known, there's this concerted effort to really crack down on private schools and have closer government supervision of private schools, which was ridiculous because Jim Keekstra taught in a public school, not a private school. He believed that there is a Jewish conspiracy and that Jews are heavily involved in promoting wars and starting wars and financing wars. And, you know, basically he said in his classroom that the Jews were disproportionately responsible for a lot of the evil in the world. And that this was, that history proved this and so on and so forth. So he was charged with the willful promotion of hatred against an identifiable group. And of course, so he availed himself of one of the defenses you can use when you're charged with a criminal code offense is to argue that the law itself under which you are being prosecuted is not valid. So he actually won in the Alberta Court of Appeal, struck down Section 319 as an unjustified violation of free expression. Jim Keekstra almost won in the Supreme Court of Canada. It split 4-3. So there's 9 justices on the Supreme Court, but sometimes they don't have, because of retirements or other reasons, they might not have a full panel of 9. So in this case, there were 7 of the 9 justices, and 4 of them upheld Section 319 as a valid restriction on free speech. They all agreed that the criminal code prohibition on willful promotion of hatred was a violation of the charter guarantee of freedom of expression. They were unanimous in that. And the government of Canada conceded that and said yes, right? So the debate was, is this justified under Section 1? And one of the reasons that 4 out of 7 said yes, this is a justified restriction on free speech, was the fact that you had these defenses. You could defend yourself against criminal charges by saying that the statements that you made were true. Okay, so it would never be a crime to speak the truth. Secondly, that if you expressed or attempted to establish by an argument an opinion on a religious subject or an opinion based on a belief in a religious text, so there's protection there. If your religion teaches something really offensive, like, you know, gay sex is sinful or our religion is the only way to get to heaven, well, then you're not going to get in trouble for those kinds of claims. The third defense is if the statements were relevant to any subject of public interest, the discussion of which was for the public benefit, and if on reasonable grounds he believed them to be true. So even there, that's a fairly broad, if you have reasonable grounds to believe that something is true, and if the statement you're making is relevant to any subject of public interest, the discussion of which was for the public benefit, you know, that's a pretty broad defense as well. And then the fourth defense, if in good faith the accused person intended to point out for the purpose of removal matters producing or tending to produce feelings of hatred towards an identifiable group in Canada. And it seems to me that fourth defense would, if there is some nasty slogan on spray painted on a wall saying, you know, death to the fill in the blank group of people, if you pointed that out for purposes of removal, you would not be criminally charged.
Okay.
And so it was a tight decision. And it's a really interesting read, by the way. And this is how Section 1 is supposed to work. You're supposed to have, you know, very, very thoughtful analysis of any breach of a charter freedom. So here you've got a criminal code ban on hate speech that violates the charter's freedom of expression guarantee. And you have 7 justices who are very thoughtful. I personally, when I read it in law school, I haven't read it recently. I was sympathetic with the dissent. No surprise. I thought the dissent was more eloquent and had better reasoning. But I would have to admit that the majority had very good, solid reasons for ruling the way it did. This wasn't like the kind of rubber stamp that we've seen the last 2 years with challenges to lockdowns and vaccine passports, where the judge basically says, well, the government said that there is a serious crisis, and the government said that the law was really good, and the government said that the law was saving lives, and the government said that the law is producing more good than harm. So we're just going to defer to the government here because, you know, it is the government after all. And then they just uphold these health orders without doing serious, thoughtful analysis and without seriously subjecting the government's arguments to some real scrutiny. And so this Keekstra decision is a good example of the way that court rulings ought to read, where you have the government is held to this standard of having to justify the violation of a charter freedom.
Well, John, that's progress. What can I say? It's 2024. Anyways, I did have a thought exercise, a little thought experiment I wanted to throw by. I don't know whether I'm just dreaming here, but suppose you get rid of this section as the Bloc proposes, that you get rid of that defense. Does that then make the whole hate speech law challengeable because it is no longer justified? I mean, those judges said, well, it's justified because of these defenses. You take away those defenses, is it no longer justified?
You know, you can argue whatever you want in court. And if this bill C-367 passes, and if they remove this religious defense from the hate speech provisions, the door is open for anybody to file a court action declaring that section, or arguing that Section 319 unjustifiably violates our free expression, and that, you know, because this religious defense is gone. But the chance of success is so slim and so remote, considering that you would have to really prove that the only reason that the Supreme Court upheld this law in 1990 was because of the religious defense. Okay. And so it would be a court claim that I think is almost doomed to failure. I think it has next to zero chance of success.
Okay.
That's my opinion. It's very subjective. Well, yeah.
I was trying. So that's okay. I just wanted a thought experiment. Go ahead. You wanted to read some examples, I believe it was.
Well, one thing I found interesting was a quote in this Globe and Mail story from Richard Marceau, who is described as the Vice President, External Affairs, and General Counsel for the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, said, quote, "No person, religious leaders included, should be able to hide behind a religious exemption to spread hate simply by using verses from a holy book or standing behind a pulpit in a house of worship," end of quote. Well, I wonder what Richard Marceau has to say about Leviticus chapter 20, verse 13, as well as other passages in the Torah that very clearly say that it's an abomination for two men to have sex with each other. Does he want Orthodox Jews to be criminally charged for preaching what is in the Torah? It's a question I have for Richard Marceau, who, of course, is not joining us on this podcast. Maybe I should shoot him an email and ask him that and see what I hear back.
That would be good. Yeah.
Okay.
You can report to us later. Okay.
Another thing referenced in the Globe and Mail article was the comments of an Muslim imam, a Muslim religious leader, at a protest in Montreal. It was a pro-Palestinian protest, October the 28th, and CBC story says, quote, "A controversial Montreal imam speech at a pro-Palestinian demonstration last month has sparked accusations of hate speech and drawn condemnation from politicians and Jewish advocacy groups. In a speech to protesters on October the 28th, Adil Sharkawi, speaking Arabic, denounced Zionist aggressors and called on Allah to, quote, kill the enemies of the people of Gaza and to spare none of them, end quote. And so we have these different people saying, well, he should be charged with hate speech. Well, here's an example of how difficult and problematic this is. He's calling on Allah to kill the enemies of the people of Gaza. So, but the context presumably is that he believes that these people have done something gravely wrong. So is it, you know, if we say that somebody guilty of first-degree murder who deliberately planned to kill somebody else. If you argue in favor of capital punishment, is that hate speech or is it a matter of justice? And so you could say, look, he's calling on Allah to kill the enemies of the people of Gaza and to spare none of them, end quote, because he believes that there's grave injustice being perpetrated against the people in Gaza. And I'm sure he's not the only person who shares that view. Now, a counterargument, to kill the enemies of the people of Gaza, well, who are the enemies of the people of Gaza? Well, presumably it's the country or the armed forces of the country that are dropping bombs and pursuing with military operations and so on and so forth. So to me, it seems pretty obvious. He's talking about Israel or Jews. So he's saying to kill the Jews or to kill the Israelites and to spare none of them. So is that the willful promotion of hatred? Well, you could say, well, yes, it is, because he's saying that the Jews should be killed, or at least the Israeli Jews should be killed. But maybe by necessary extension, he's saying that any Jew anywhere in the world that agrees with what the Israeli government is currently doing. I mean, it's
completely subjective. I mean, that's the problem.
Unfortunately.
I don't know if it's subjective, but it's really tough to tell. I don't know how they can. Okay, I just want to point out something, because that I actually found that example really weird to be included in this article, because nowhere in what they quoted does he rely on any religious text to support what he says.
Excellent point. Excellent point. He does not say that the Quran says that the enemies of the people of Gaza, no. So he's not citing a religious text.
Yeah, I know. So why is this included? And how can they use this to support their argument? Is really a stretch. Well, anyways,
that's an even stronger point than you know whether or not he is running afoul of the legislation. Is that even if he is running afoul of the legislation, he's not quoting from a religious text.
Yeah, yeah.
So
that's probably a good place to leave it off, because it is so deliberately misconstruing the whole concept. Anyways, I'm sure other people are going to start commenting on it, but I was really surprised after seeing that story in the Globe and Mail that nobody else has commented to this point on it yet. I hope other people will notice what's going on, because, you know, if they want to amend the Online Harms Act to include it instead of just pushing this bill C-367, you know, I mean, that's another workaround, and I don't like them trying to do it that way either, so. Perhaps we can move on now to the other column that you wrote. And this one, of course, received a lot of play on social media, especially on X, where people were, you know, retweeting it and liking it. And then actually what happened was it was released in a bit of a tweet, and then you expanded it, wrote it into a column. Then the column got published and people started referring to the column. And so it got even more exposure. Okay, this is about the nurses and doctors that did not take the COVID shot and were not hired back in, I think, specifically BC and Ontario?
Yes.
Okay. All right. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
So the Ontario situation is that if you are a nurse or doctor or other healthcare worker, if you want to work in a hospital, that hospital requires that any health professional working there must have been injected with the COVID vaccine in 2021, or, you know, if you want to get it now, or if you want to get a new and improved upgraded vaccine, but you cannot work in a hospital in Ontario without getting injected. This is so utterly unscientific when you consider that COVID never was going to be like the Spanish flu of 1918, which is the big lie that Dr. Neil Ferguson of Imperial College London, as well as the vast majority of our politicians and chief medical officers, et cetera, were peddling this fear that COVID was going to be this unusually deadly killer. Now, it did prove to be a deadly killer, but not an unusually deadly killer. And anybody who looks at the death stats in any province in Canada, any country in the world, you see that COVID was not the major threat that it was made out to be. But apart from that, the vaccine didn't stop the spread. There was no evidence when they made it mandatory that the vaccine would stop the spread. Zero evidence at that time. There's wishful thinking. Yes, wishful thinking. We hope it will stop the spread. Was there evidence that the vaccine would stop the spread? No, there was none. And then, of course, by Christmas of 2021, we see that it didn't stop the spread. You've got, you know, Gibraltar 97% vaccinated, and the government's telling people, do not gather at Christmas time, don't have Christmas dinner together because the virus is spreading everywhere. And this is with, you know, a small country with, I don't know if it's an independent country or governed by Britain, but whatever, a small jurisdiction with 97% of the people vaccinated. So there's no medical or scientific reason for anybody to get injected, because it doesn't stop. Getting injected with COVID vaccine did not stop the spread. That is the only reason why you could potentially justify forcing people to get it. But if it's purely a matter of, you know, it's going to help me to not get COVID, which of course that didn't work. People who got the shot got COVID anyways. But if it's going to help me to not have severe symptoms, or if I believe that it's going to spare my life and I'm not going to die, okay, great. Personal choice, take it or don't take it. So just a reminder, there is zero scientific basis for this. But now today in 2024, if you're a nurse in Ontario, if you haven't been injected in 2021, and if you don't want to get injected now, because they do have shots available, if you want to work, you can get a COVID injection now, right? Like, why would anybody take a COVID injection in 2024? I mean, it's nuts. Anyway, the Ontario government whines and complains publicly about shortages of nurses and other health professionals. And at the same time, these people can't work. Technically, it's each local hospital that's got the unscientific, vindictive political rule in place. However, because hospitals are 100% government funded, the Ontario's health minister could end this tomorrow and simply write a letter to the hospitals and say, I'm hereby informing you that you are to drop your ban, your prohibition on nurses who didn't get injected not being able to work at your hospital.
Right.
Now, BC is similar. It's more of BC is not the local hospitals. It's a higher level. It's Bonnie Henry, and it's the government that is preventing people from going back to work.
Right. I just want to point out there were a couple of common themes in the reaction to the postings of your column. The first one, most of the critics were saying, well, I prefer my nurses not be able to, you know, pick and choose what science they believed in. You know, I would prefer that they believed in science. So obviously the critics, or most of the critics, at least on X, that are attacking you, are saying, sorry, you got the science wrong, and so did those nurses. There's no way that they should be hired back because they are, well, I guess they would call them scientifically incompetent. Those are my words. That's not what they were saying. They were just saying, I wish that they believed in science. So there's that. Do you have anything? Yeah. You basically said that that's been disproven, so I don't know whether we need to have you reply on that, but perhaps I'll just give you the opportunity to say something.
You know, if any of these people, most of these people will never debate you. If you want to say, okay, well, let's look at the evidence. Show me the evidence. Show me medical data from August 2021, September 2021, that showed that the vaccine stops the spread of COVID. Show me the evidence. They're not going to be able to produce anything because there's nothing in existence. Even if there had been, I'll take it a step further, even if there was some report that suggested in August of 2021 that the vaccine stops the spread, that would have been disproven because science moves, science changes. Science is a process, not a conclusion. So by December of 2021, the science was pretty clear that the vaccine didn't stop the spread because COVID, the Delta variant, the Omicron variant, they were all spreading everywhere, and even in populations with high vaccination rates. So what is the science that they're referring to? When these people say science, they're referring to what they heard the CBC say, what they heard a politician say, what they heard the premier say, what they heard the chief medical officer say. It's, you know, whatever comes out of the mouth of a politician is the science.
Right.
And that's it.
Experts say. Okay.
Oh, yeah, experts.
Yes. The most of the support for you actually was speculation in a way. It was really interesting because I know you as a responsible commentator will not speculate without evidence, of course. But of course, on social media, That's what they all do. And so there was lots of speculation as to why this was happening. And that was the, I think the most common theme was that they, these people just cannot admit that they were wrong or they are wrong. You know, this is why they're holding fast to keeping these people out of work because they don't want to admit that they were wrong. Any comment on that? Even though it is speculation, you know, do you have any thoughts on as to why they're doing this?
I think it's a combination of vindictiveness and arrogance. I mean, this is just cruel to it hurts the doctors and nurses in British Columbia. The Justice Center, by the way, we provided lawyers in a court action that's called Tatlow. We are waiting for the court's ruling. This was argued in December. It's cruel to the individual doctors and nurses who cannot go back to work. It's also cruel to patients because in a system, especially in BC, where you have a shortage of healthcare workers, and so fewer doctors and nurses means that patients are waiting longer to get the care that they need. So it's very cruel. It's just it's vindictive. It's like, you know, I was on a power trip. I told you to get injected, and you didn't want to get injected. Well, now, you know, 2.5 years later, I'm telling you, you're still going to be unemployed until you bow to my will and do what I told you to do and get injected. It's a power trip. It's vindictive. And that ties in with what other people said. They just don't want to admit that they were wrong. They don't have the humility. They're very arrogant.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, those two jurisdictions, Ontario and BC, they still have sort of the same regime that they had during the COVID period. That is, the medical officers are the same. There's been no rollover at all. So it's essentially the same people that were involved in the bringing it in that are involved in these decisions to keep it the way it is. Well, it's in limbo. We just leave it at that for the moment until they can come around.
Well, people need to talk to their MLA. I've told these nurses and doctors in some of the conversations, and I feel for them. It's horrible. They say, have you talked to your MPP, your member of provincial parliament, the Ontario terminology, or your MLA, your member of legislative assembly for British Columbia? And surprisingly, they say, no, they have not. I said, well, phone your MPP, phone your MLA, ask for a meeting, sit down and explain to them that, you know, you're ready, willing, and able to go back to work, but their government is preventing them from working. You have to get the word out. Some of the people I've spoken with as well, they say that people are shocked to hear. They don't know this. People in British Columbia, most people in BC, don't know that there are nurses and doctors that are being prevented from going back to work. But, you know, these people have to create that public awareness. It doesn't happen by itself.
Okay, there you go. A call to action from John. Good enough. I just want to move on to one last story here. This one is, I don't think I'm going to get you to comment necessarily on the substance of it, but just sort of what it implies for the society and our constitution, I guess, and our politics. This was a story about an RCMP report, a secret RCMP report that got leaked that essentially said that Canadians are on the verge of revolution. Or, you know, agitation. I don't know. It sounded like Mad Max Road War. That's the kind of thing that they were implying. And the reason I wanted to ask you about it, because if true, it would indicate that Canadians are giving up on their politics and giving up on their constitution, their belief in the constitution as a safeguard for the society. Do you see that in what this report is saying or what it is implying?
Well, let's just dive in to, and I'll quote some of the sections as quoted in, there's a National Post story, there's a True North story, there's a Western Standard story, and there's probably others. So this is a secret RCMP report warns of paranoid populism coming to Canada. That's the headline with True North. The National Post headline was, secret RCMP report warns Canadians may revolt once they realize how broke they are. So just a few quotes here and there from the report. Much of it was redacted, but here's a quote from the report. RCMP report being presented presumably to the Prime Minister, the cabinet, or certain cabinet ministers, or the higher, if not the politicians themselves, then the higher echelons of the federal civil service. So, quote, the coming period of recession will accelerate the decline in living standards that the younger generations have already witnessed compared to earlier generations. For example, many Canadians under 35 are unlikely ever to be able to buy a place to live, end quote. Another quote, the situation will probably deteriorate further in the next 5 years as the early effects of climate change and a global recession add their weight in the ongoing crises. Another section addressing climate change says, quote, Canadians can expect extreme weather events and drought, which will reduce the global output of a variety of commodities, causing greater scarcity in developed countries. Aside from the coming extreme weather crisis that will likely happen in close succession or even concurrently, the report also warns of, quote, paranoid populism. I guess it's in contrast to the non-paranoid populism. I don't know.
All this bad stuff's going to be happening, but, you know, if you believe it's happening, then you're paranoid.
Well, I'll never forget the conspiracy theory that I read in 2020 that said this 2 weeks to flatten the curve is not going to be 2 weeks. It's going to go on for years, and then people are going to become so fed up with lockdowns that when the government introduces the vaccine and promises the vaccine as the way out of lockdowns, everybody's going to get vaccinated. Initially, it'll all be voluntary, but then the government is going to pressure people into getting vaccinated, and there's going to be, you know, job losses and second-class citizenship, and you can't travel. That was I read that in 2020. So thank it's God, not going to be 2 weeks. Yeah, well, thank God that was just a paranoid whack job, nut bar, conspiracy kook who said that the 2 weeks to flatten the curve would be years, and that we were going to have mandatory vaccination policies to pressure and coerce people into getting injected with a brand new vaccine for which there's no long-term safety data.
That's right.
That was paranoia of that was the conspiracy theory of 2020.
Yeah, so Mr. RCMP writer or Ms. Failed to see the paranoia here because it sounds like bad stuff's going to happen. Okay.
So according to the report, quote, authoritarian movements have been on the rise in many liberal democratic nations, as populists have been capitalizing on the rise of political polarization and conspiracy theories, which allow them to tailor their message to extremist movements. So let me tackle a few of those. Authoritarian movements. I mean, if anybody's been authoritarian here, it's been governments, point blank. They've been extremely authoritarian. They have, you know, Jason Kenney has locked up pastors in jail. We saw violence, the Trudeau government illegally, Justice Center launched the court action and put Canadians before the courts who had suffered. That was our court action. We were the first to follow court action. And that, you know, almost 2 years later, there was a ruling that the Prime Minister acted illegally. That was the Justice Center who started that process. Fortunately, there were other groups also that followed court applications, which were joined with ours. And then we got a court ruling in respect of all of those applications together. So it was a government that used violence against a peaceful protest in Ottawa. It's the governments that have violated our Charter of Freedoms of Association. It's the colleges that have prosecuted and removed the licenses from medical doctors for publicly disagreeing with the government's narrative. So it's so far-fetched to talk about authoritarian movements have been on the rise. Well, no, it's the governments that have been authoritarian. The pro-freedom movements, I don't know what is authoritarian about them. Anyway, capitalizing on the rise of political polarization and conspiracy theories. Okay, yeah, we've dealt with conspiracy theories. To tailor their message to extremist movements. What is extremist? Like wanting to have Christmas dinner with both of your parents? When the health fascists have said you cannot have two strangers come to your house or two people come to your house that normally don't, it can only be one, you know.
Oh yeah,
extremist is whatever you want it to be.
No, well, this is all in keeping with what we're seeing worldwide, which are all these people that are proclaiming that these populist movements are authoritarian. So we must end democracy in order to save it. You know, that's essentially what they're saying. And I guess My opening question to you was, are we giving up on our politics and our Constitution? It sounds like I should have said our governments and politicians giving up on politics and our Constitution. The people seem to be relying or trying to rely on it while you guys do away with those things.
Yeah, I agree with you. And this is laying the groundwork for more censorship of our speech. The report also warns of people having too much access to data now through social media and the internet. Too much access. Kevin, do you have too much access to data?
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah. It's making me tell the truth too much.
Which will allow, quote, private entities to develop the means. Private entity. You don't want private entities to do anything. No. You want everything done by government, right? Anyway, the problem here is that private entities can develop the means to exercise undue influence over individuals.
We're looking at you,
and populations at an unprecedented level. So this is like the free exchange of ideas, which, you know, it's different today compared to 30 years ago, because I think the internet has changed things probably for the worse in some ways, but maybe for the better in others. I mean, it's different, but what they're basically upset about here is people have too much access to data now through the internet, so private entities can exercise undue influence over individuals. Oh, right, because government should be telling us what the truth is, right?
They only have our good in mind.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the arrogance here of bureaucrats and politicians, I mean, do they actually believe that everything that they're saying is true? They've lost their awareness of their own dishonesty? How many things have been, how many lies have been told in the last 4 years of the whole lockdowns and vaccine passports? If we all get injected, you know, this is going to stop the spread and we're going to have herd immunity because of vaccination. And the initial big lies.
Don't take that for that fish.
You're not a horse. Yeah.
What was that fish bowl cleaner? Oh yeah. Man, oh man.
Another quote: law enforcement should expect continuing social and political polarization fueled by misinformation campaigns and an increasing mistrust for all democratic institutions. End of quote. Man, mistrust for Democrats, does it occur to them that maybe it's Parliament itself and the way that it behaves that causes Parliament to be mistrusted? Has it occurred to the authors of this report that maybe the way that courts have behaved in the last 2 or 3 years causes a lot of people to not trust the courts? But no. Anybody who mistrusts Parliament, anybody who mistrusts the courts, it's because of misinformation. So in other words, if you're smart, you're going to trust Parliament and the courts, but if you don't, you're stupid. You've just been misinformed.
Yeah. And at the same time, of course, trust in democratic institutions is being daily eroded as we discover what they've been doing with our money vis-a-vis procurement. Big story.
Well, you just look at why would you expect Canadians to trust politicians when you look at the whole ArriveCan scandal? And everything that's gone on there.
Yes, I know. Well, I don't have time to go into it, but there's a big scandal breaking out of BC where an entity that was basically given the ability to hand out grants was asking for something called a success fee. This was the word they were using for kickback. You know, if you got the grant, then you had to pay a success fee. You know, this is like protection, I suppose. Anyways, I'll put a link to it if you want to read up.
Right. It's interesting to see the word polarization used repeatedly as a bad thing. I think polarization is part of a healthy democracy. And as long as the people are not, you know, beating each other up and burning each other's houses down and throwing rocks at each other and, you know, killing each other, polarization is normal. You look at British politics, you've got, since 1945, you've got the flip-flop back and forth between Labour and Conservative. They believed different things. They had different policies. And of course, you know, both parties have changed over the years. It's been said that the Labour Party in Britain, after 3 or 4 terms of Thatcher or Thatcherism, The Labour Party had very different policies on unions than what it did have back in the 1970s. We see polarization in British Columbia. You had the back and forth between the NDP versus the Socreds. It was never violent. I grew up in BC. It was just elections. Was it polarized? Yeah, you bet it was polarized. But most provinces, you've got two big parties. In Quebec, for many decades, it was the Parti Québécois versus the Provincial Liberal Party. It was polarized. Those two parties pretty much cleaned up, had close to 100% of the seats in a lot of elections. That's not the case today. Things have morphed into Quebec provincial politics now are very different. We've got four parties represented in the legislature. But now more recently, I think we do have polarization between people that agreed with the government's lockdown policies and people that disagreed. And you've got some polarization today, like these people on Twitter that think that, these nurses that didn't get injected with a COVID vaccine are a bunch of anti-science Neanderthals. So it's only right and fair and just that they still be unemployed because you don't want to hire idiots like that who are anti-science. Okay, so you got people that think that way. They actually believe everything the politicians and the media said. And then you got people, like myself included, that say, no, these were the worst human rights violations in decades. These policies were utterly unscientific. They inflicted and caused far more harm than good. Is there polarization? Yeah, there certainly is. Well, what's wrong with that? It's a democracy. So you're going to have people with different opinions. So unless people are violent, I don't see what the problem is with polarization.
Same with civility. It's normal. They always talk, whenever politicians start getting hammered, that is, people start yelling at them, the elderly statesman like Jean Charest say, well, we got to, talk about the civility now, because, the tone police move in and start trying to correct everybody, lower the temperature. Well, that's the polarization. That is the normal to and fro of politics.
Well, should we aspire for the civility that Ontario Premier Doug Ford extended towards anti-lockdown protesters back in 2020 when he said, these people are idiots and they're yahoos and they're endangering everybody's lives? Is that the level of civility? Or sure. Prime Minister Trudeau promoting hatred against the unvaccinated, or more accurately, promoting hatred against people who had not taken the COVID shot, called them extremists, misogynists, anti-science, so on and so forth. Is that the civility that we aspire to of the Ontario Premier and the Canadian Prime Minister?
I guess so. I'm down with that. Anyways.
The other thing I wanted to mention, as always, is my heartfelt thanks and gratitude to all the people who donate to the Justice Center. You make it possible for our team of lawyers and paralegals and communication staff to fight hard for your rights and freedoms in the courts of law and in the court of public opinion. And so please go to www.jccf.ca and donate, and we will give you an official tax receipt. We'll send that out in February of 2025. So please donate to defend freedom in Canada, and my gratitude to the generosity of all the good people, truth-loving, freedom-loving, justice-loving Canadians who make it possible for the Justice Center to carry out its work.
Right. And John will keep writing columns, and I will continue to talk and talk, despite the polarization and incivility. Thanks, John, for being here for this episode of Justice with John Carpe. I hope to speak to you again real soon.
Thank you, Kevin. Have a good week.